The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott. This week, Boris Johnson took a tour of the UK, booed by protesters in Scotland, cuddling chickens in Wales, and then heading to Belfast. At Stormont, he met five of Northern Ireland's main political parties, where the focus was to discuss the restoration of power sharing. But Brexit is never off the agenda, and the meetings ended with multiple dire warnings from many of the parties about how damaging no deal would be, and whether it could even result in a border poll. So what is Johnson's plan in the case of no deal? Also this week, how the revival of the Lib Dems in Westminster could begin in the hills of Wales. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. Boris Johnson has been Prime Minister for a week now, and it feels like a very different kind of regime. So far, he's taken 6 days to pick up the phone to Ireland's leader, and then refused to meet EU leaders unless they scrap the backstop. But he has had a friendly phone call with Donald Trump. As the week has gone on, with a blitz of promising on no-deal spending, extra police and more cash for schools, are his sights set on something more than just leaving the EU? Many in Westminster have been asking, is this, in fact, an election campaign? Well, I'm joined to discuss all this by Martin Kettle from The Guardian, Katie Balls from The Spectator, and Stephanie Lloyd from Labour pressure group Progress. Katie, is there anything really that's been surprising about Boris Johnson's first week? I mean, there was obviously that sort of round of mass sackings, but beyond that, the sort of blitz of spending promises and a kind of refusal to go and really undertake any new negotiations with the EU, is there any of that behaviour surprising?
Well, I think in the Tory leadership campaign, no one exactly knew what Boris Johnson's precise Brexit plan would be. Some said that was because he didn't have one, but also it's because he has this tendency to say enough for people to read what they want from his comments. So I think what has been illuminating is probably how hard line he has been on his Brexit position. So there was some talk about tweaking the backstop, potentially going for a time limit. Now we hear that it has to be abolished, and it is repeatedly referred to as being the undemocratic backstop. And I think that is more drastic than some of his supporters had thought. Now there's still questions about what exactly it means to abolish the backstop, you know, what would make it acceptable. But this refusal to meet with EU leaders until they're willing to agree to something they have said many times they're not going to agree to, I think is more on the hard line end of the Brexit position that some of his supporters, if you think about MPs in the middle of the Tory party who came out for him, had expected. But that said, I think there is still unity. We are just over a week in, so perhaps that isn't too surprising, but there's still unity behind the message. And as for all these, I suppose, sellable policies. So you've seen a big rush of attempts by the Boris Johnson government to, if you look at their train link that they were talking about at the weekend, and since then we expect to focus on the NHS. I don't think that is surprising because speak to anyone in Westminster, Boris Johnson supporters or Labour MPs, there is a sense that a general election could be imminent. Now, there's still doubt about how it would come about. Would Boris Johnson call it himself? I think that's unlikely. But because it's so fragile with the parliamentary arithmetic, there is a sense that this is a government that has no time to waste and wants to try and endear itself to the public as quickly as possible, hence why they're trying to get this domestic agenda out there in good news policies.
Martin, has he got a bit of an electoral sweet spot there that's, you know, kind of right wing on Brexit, hard Brexit, get us out by October 31st, but also opening the chequebook, spending money on the NHS, spending money on transport? Is that kind of where the electorate are?
That's certainly a possibility, and it makes quite a lot of sense given the fact that Brexit has absolutely drowned out every other domestic political issue since the 2017 election. So in that sense, yes. I mean, the hard facts don't yet support the fact that that is an electoral sweet spot. And, you know, as Katie said, I mean, it is only a week in. It's the summer. Labour is as quiet as a mouse. We've got the by-election this week. So there's lots of things that are different from the sort of normal run-of-the-mill politics, if such a thing still exists. So it's a logical position to take, and I can see that it might conceivably cohere into an election winning position if he pulls it off. But I think there's many a slip, and I don't think that it's at all clear that that's going to work out.
Stephanie, do you sort of buy that this is all part of an imminent kind of election strategy, or is it less calculated than that? It's just trying to make a good impression in its first week.
I mean, I think if it was just down to Boris, I would say it was probably slightly less calculated and slightly more opportunistic. But I think bringing in someone like Dominic Cummings really shows just how calculated he wants to be with the people around him. Even if, as Katie says, it would probably be quite unlikely that he would be the person that calls the election, particularly before anything happens with Brexit, there is still the real possibility that that could happen. So I'm not surprised at all that they seem to be gearing up quite substantially on election footing. I mean, you saw the sheer amount of Facebook ads that went out within the first day of data gathering and trying to collect as much information as possible. So I think they really are gearing up for that. And also because I think the whole thing will crumble. You can't say quite happily, we will just have no deal, doesn't matter what the consequences are, throwing billions of extra pounds into no deal preparation. We know the pound's already looking worse than it has done for a long time. It's going to get even worse. There is no way you can say that and then throw open the checkbook and also say that you're going to cut taxes. None of this works just as any form of economics that's going to make any sense or last any real period of time. So I think they know the trouble that they're going to get into. I think what they will try and do is kind of secure themselves as much as they can before the wheels really start to fall off the bus.
Katie, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the kind of team he's building in Downing Street. So a lot of them are kind of Vote Leave veterans. They're very much campaigners. Tell us a little bit about that.
Boris Johnson surrounds himself with lots of factions and different groups. And I mean, it's been described as more of a court than I think previous leaders. And I think he's quite happy to play them off against each other. But what's interesting is the two forces that I think have the strongest presence in number 10 are City Hall, so the people who surrounded himself when he was Mayor of London, but more powerful now are Vote Leave. And initially, Eddie Lister was announced to, or was seen to be getting this role of Chief of Staff, which should in theory be the most powerful role. And that's from Boris Johnson's days as Mayor. But then you had, as Stephanie points out, Dominic Cummings move in. And since then you have Lee Kane as the Director of Communications, also Vote Leave. And I think there's a whole host of people who are on the Vote Leave campaign. You also look at the cabinet that he has assembled. And if you look at the most senior positions, Sajid Javid aside, those candidates all were involved with the Vote Leave campaign. And even if you look at perhaps some of the surprise appointments, so no one saw Andrea Leadsom going to Bays, for example. I think Matt Hancock and Liz Truss were repeatedly spoken about. Now, Teresa Villiers going to DEFRA, what do they both have in common? They were on the Vote Leave campaign. So I think there was a real sense that the people at the top of number 10, people like Dom Cummings, want to assemble a group of people they know where they are on Brexit. They've worked with them before because they know how quickly things could get quite hairy if you are playing this game of the EU of saying, we're not going to blink. And I think you can see that in the government. I think when it comes to what exactly they're planning for, I think this is a government that is in campaign mode. And you can see that with the fact that the Vote Leave team has assembled again. I saw Paul Stevenson, one of the few Vote Leave staffers who's not actually in number 10, said on social media, you know, what's that sound? It's the sound of the band getting back together. So there is that sense, but I still think that the strategy, if you are going to call it one, on being in campaign mode, is they hope that by preparing for a general election and by trying to have these good news policies, there is enough of an increase in popularity in the polls that they actually manage to avoid a general election. So if you show that Boris Johnson can probably win a general election, get a large majority that would then give him this no-deal mandate, perhaps MPs might play ball, but also the EU might then take him seriously without him having to go and get it. Now, I don't know if that would necessarily work, but if it doesn't, at least you're prepared for the general election, which might come if it fails.
Martin, how much do you think this kind of government in campaign mode, the threat of a general election, might spook backbenchers both on the Tory and Labour side into maybe voting for any deal that might turn up in order as a way to avoid it?
Well, I think that's a real possibility on both sides. I think there is a recognition generally across the House of Commons that a general election is coming within months. I mean, it may be within weeks. There's been a little bit of talk that there might be a kind of last-minute conversion, you know, Damascene rush of conversion to something like the May deal in order to sort of prevent the election from being wholly dominated by Brexit. But I mean, that's just not going to happen. On the Tory side, I think it puts a lot of heat on what you might call the Tory Remainers, the Tory moderates, the people who basically hated the idea of Boris Johnson becoming Prime Minister and are opposed fundamentally or at least say they are, to no deal. They look to me at the moment to be in some confusion about how to respond. And that's been true, in fact, on most of the key votes that they've been on this. They've threatened more than they've actually delivered. And I think that's an important part of the calculation in Downing Street. They're all talk and no action.
Stephanie, how does it play into, do you think, Labour MPs' thinking and also the Labour leadership's thinking on ramping up preparations for a general election? I'm not 100% sure we've seen huge signs of that yet, but you know, certainly what some Labour MPs might be thinking about potentially voting for the deal in order to avoid no deal and also potentially to avoid a snap general election.
I mean, I think from the leadership side, we've not really seen anything on that. And I think, if anything, the only thing that we've seen, unfortunately, is Labour focus itself internally yet again. So the minute there seems to be a real problem, the attention goes straight back to what's happening within the Labour Party and whether or not we're going to have the same MPs at the next election. And it goes into trying to trigger and therefore deselect, an attempt to deselect lots of current MPs, which
that's,
I think,
the priority, it seems.
That is currently what seems to be the priority of the leadership of the Labour Party, which I think is pretty shameful, to be honest, particularly when we've seen in the last week Boris Johnson form what is almost arguably the most right-wing government we've had in decades. And with all of this talk of unity, with all of this talk of kind of giveaway policies, it's actually a deeply divisive government in terms of lots of their social policies, but also then in terms of what they'll do economically. And they've turned around and said, you know, well, we'll bring back all of these police. It's like, well, those are the police that you have just cut for the last 9 years. I mean, none of this is new. You know, currently we are only seeing the leadership of the Labour Party. They're not touching Boris and the things that he's doing currently, which I think the country, and you can kind of tell in terms of where we are in the polls, is frankly quite fed up of it, because nobody thinks this is a good government. No one thinks the Conservative government for the last 3 years previously under Theresa May was a good functioning government. And I think people are crying out for a level of leadership. And yet again, as I say, we've turned in on ourselves to try and have, you know, yet another civil war as to what we do and who it is that represents us, which is, I mean, frankly, just ludicrous.
Kit, does it feel like Labour on the pitch at all in the last few weeks in terms of challenging stuff that Boris has been saying?
I mean, from my perspective, I think Labour have been more focused on attacking Jo Swinson.
That's an interesting strategy, though, potentially, though.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but covering both of those leadership launches. Both were announced on the same week. You had Jo Swinson earlier in the week and then Boris Johnson. And I was really struck by the fact that Labour politicians, I suppose Jeremy Corbyn's outriders on Twitter, seem to be spending more time. I mean, if you looked at the comments, they were going after, you know, neoliberal agenda, you know, enabling austerity and a Tory, and you thought that would be Boris Johnson, but it was actually Jo Swinson they were describing. I think that there have been some attacks on Boris Johnson, but it seems to me that and perhaps there's some logic in this, because I think there are some Labour voters who are never going to support Boris Johnson, and ultimately the Boris Johnson pitch is to go and win back Brexit Party voters first. I think the priority is to reunite that Leave vote and then try and get back with some centrist domestic policies of her agenda. So perhaps that's why they feel there's less of a need to go and attack on Boris Johnson. But the main attack lines I've seen from Labour are all about the Lib Dems, and clearly because they see that as a threat in terms of their pro-EU membership.
Well, it's not just that, is it? It's that, I mean, you're absolutely right. I agree with you very much. But it's deep in the DNA of the Labour left to attack the people closest to it. The people they really hate in politics are other factions of the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats who contend for the Liberal left vote across the country. And they hate them. The Tories, in a way, they're not so bothered about. And they've got this ridiculous idea, in my opinion, that somehow or other, because Boris Johnson is, they can stick the right-wing, same old Tories label on him, that somehow or other this will overcome all Jeremy Corbyn's huge electoral problems on the night. There's lots and lots of good, serious, well-grounded reasons for thinking that Labour could do quite badly in the next general election. And I think that's, in a way, also, you know, the refusal to face that is part of the reason that they get into, you know, their sort of default comfort mode of attacking traitors and liberals who are really Tories, which they aren't.
But I also think, I mean, it's quite interesting in terms of where they're thinking with the Lib Dems, because so I live in Streatham, and they've started much earlier than they ever said they were going to. the selection of the next MP for Streatham earlier than all of the other seats within which have had those vacancies. And it is that fear of the Liberal Democrats, I think, because when you look at how well Labour did well in the 2017 election, it is in all of those kind of very metropolitan areas that are very, very pro-Remain. They talk about the increased vote share, but that was very concentrated in big cities. It was just more people in Islington voting for us rather than the broad sweep across, which is why, despite in some Labour Party circles and contrary to popular belief, we didn't win. It is that fear that I think that they know that even that part of the vote share will start to be hoovered up. And then if Jeremy loses another election, it's certainly not guaranteed anymore that he would go in the kind of normal conventions of that. But it does make his position much less tenable if it is a situation where they can't even say the kind of vote share that they've got has increased rather than just the number of seats. So I totally agree that the Lib Dems are who they're going for.
Okay, thanks all. We'll be back after this. This week, the PM travelled to Northern Ireland to talk with the five main parties about their country's future. After 2.5 years without a government, after a breakdown in the power sharing between the DUP and the Sinn Féin, Johnson has chosen this moment to step in and bring the two parties to the table. So why, ostensibly, Katie, might be, you know, going to Belfast, talking about power sharing, be high on Boris Johnson's agenda, or is it not actually that high, and is it mainly to go there and talk about Brexit?
Well, I don't think you're going to have a Prime Minister who takes a hands-back stance on whether it's, you know, to restore power sharing at Stormont. Clearly, it's something that everyone will want to do. I think for Boris Johnson, it would be incredibly helpful to his Brexit strategy if Stormont could be restored and there was power sharing. When we interviewed Boris Johnson for The Spectator during the Tory leadership campaign, he spoke about the various ways he would try to mitigate or plan or prepare for a no-deal Brexit. And among the four things was restoring power sharing. I also think it's important to the Boris Johnson strategy for actually getting a Brexit deal. Because if you look at how Boris Johnson talks about the backstop, he repeatedly calls it undemocratic. Now, one potential response to that would be, well, if you're saying it's undemocratic, why not let the parties at Stormont, the parties in Northern Ireland, have a say over what is in the backstop, how they want to use it? Now, you can't make the argument if there is no power sharing at Stormont. So if you were able to get it up, I think that that would provide a route to potentially solving the backstop problem.
Martin, we've seen a bit of a tour of the UK by Boris Johnson, but we haven't seen him or seen to be any plans at all to go to tour around the rest of the EU and speak to EU leaders. And it's taken him 6 days to ring Leo Varadkar and you know, essentially just reiterate his campaign talking points about abolishing the backstop. That doesn't seem promising in terms of negotiating a great new deal, as he says he wants to do.
No, it doesn't. And I mean, one of the things that we haven't mentioned yet in this context is the Brexit Party. And quite a lot of this early strategy of Boris Johnson seems to me to be all about trying to snuff out the Brexit Party. That's a large reason why he got as much support at Westminster as he did in that phase of the leadership election.
People were spooked
by the European election results when the Conservatives, just to remind us, got less than 10% of the vote for the first time ever in a UK-wide election. So, you know, that was deeply serious threat to Tory MPs who face a general election in the next few months. I mean, I would suspect that there's a huge amount more going on in terms of under the radar discussion with European capitals, even with the Commission, though it's in its final weeks of its existence, than we know. I'm not saying there's a huge amount of negotiation going on, but I suspect there's quite a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. We shouldn't just think that because it's not in the Downing Street grid for, you know, announcements, that there is nothing going on. But in the end, the irresistible force is going to hit an immovable object, and at some point down the line, there's going to have to be some discussion involving the new Prime Minister, which addresses the question of the backstop. The idea that the Stormont Assembly could somehow cut through all this is, I think, just for the birds.
It could, you know, be a reassurance to Tory MPs, for example.
Well, they could say it is and tell people that it is. But, I mean, the situation in Northern Ireland's got worse the two sides are pretty implacably opposed to each other. Everything's still a zero-sum game. So the idea that somehow this could really be a democratically endorsed backstop when the majority of opinion in Northern Ireland is opposed to it, it's a high-wire, dangerous game that is being played here.
And do you think that Mary Lee McDonald's, should the Sinn Féin leaders, comments that particularly a no-deal Brexit would mean the circumstances are fundamentally changed enough to mean there should be a border poll. Do you think that's the right assessment?
I think that is quite provocative at the moment, but I think it's...
Certainly not something that Dublin seems to want.
No, Dublin does not want that at all. And, I mean, Sinn Féin, remember, is in a relatively weak position in terms of Irish public opinion over the last 20 years. It didn't do very well in the European elections in the Republic, because it's moved on from the Gerry Adams, Martin McGuinness generation, which got a lot of ethnic solidarity, if you like, partisan solidarity, because of what was going on in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. It's a bit more difficult for Sinn Féin to establish its unique selling point now, except as the party that won't give in to the DUP, which, of course, it won't.
Stephanie, do you believe that Boris Johnson's really got any kind of strategy around Northern Ireland and the border? He says he's going full tilt for no deal, and he also promises there'll never be border infrastructure. Is there really any kind of coherent plan there?
No, I don't think there is. And I think the thing that is truly scary is just how brazen the Conservative Party have been with peace in Northern Ireland and pursuing this kind of idea of no deal as if there are no consequences to this whatsoever. And, you know, the idea that Boris Johnson calls that undemocratic, when he wasn't elected Prime Minister by the people of this country, it was by just over 100,000 people. There was nothing during that referendum campaign that said, don't worry, the billions of pounds that we're going to save and the millions that we're going to spend on the NHS, you know, that was on the side of the bus, isn't actually going to frontline services where you think it will be. It will be stockpiling medicines and buying fridges, because otherwise we're scared that we're going to run out of them. And I think, you know, we have moved so far now from the original mandate that was given in terms of the reality of what it is. I think the idea that saying just the backstop is undemocratic is slightly farcical. And I think that's why at some point it feels like we've kind of gone round, and I've kind of forgotten, we all have, how many times we've said all of it. It feels like something has to move at some point, and someone has to start being honest with the reality of the situation. But I just don't know how we get there. And I think if you're looking to stall any level of democracy back into this, I think the only way to do it is through a second referendum with a genuine understanding of what the reality of the situation could be. But it's still, even seeing how that gets through any form of kind of parliamentary arithmetic seems almost impossible currently. But yeah, the idea that he has any kind of real concern for what's happening in Ireland just can't be true when he will talk so brazenly about no deal, knowing the consequences.
Katie, there's so much, we're seeing so much ramping up of so-called no-deal preparations, an extra $2 billion, like $100 million on advertising campaigns. Is this really just to try and persuade Brussels that the UK is serious about no-deal, or is it something that Boris Johnson is prepared to see through?
Well, Boris Johnson is still very keen to insist, I'll get the number, it's one in a million chance of no deal. But you look at Michael Gove and his comments, and he is effectively in charge of no deal preparations, and he's suggesting it's now the assumed outcome. So I think Boris Johnson genuinely believes that by preparing for no deal, you don't get to no deal. I think that those around him are probably more aware that you do get to no deal if that doesn't work, if you don't have that gamble. And I think that if you look at the people he has surrounded himself, so Dom Cummings, as we spoke about earlier, and all the senior Brexiteers in his team, I do think that this is a government that probably won't blink if you get to the end of October and it hasn't been allowed. Now, one of the other things is, will Parliament actually allow this government to get there? I think maybe that is priced in by some of the people in this team, which is, you might not actually get to no deal because others will stop you. I think in terms of optics, one thing is clear, is this is a government that wants to look as though it is prepared for no deal, and to do that is prepared to spend a lot of money and release a lot of funds, which Philip Hammond never wanted to do. I do think that if you follow that through, by preparing so much, you are seeing how much you can mitigate some of the negative outcomes that can potentially come from that situation.
Martin, do you think some people in Number 10, perhaps Boris Johnson himself, might be banking on the fact that Parliament would prevent a no deal? And can they even?
There's a lot of discussion, as you know, about whether that they can. I mean, the numbers appear to be there. Last time they were tested, admittedly, it was in a kind of dry run kind of vote. It could all change. And as you imply, it could all change for the worse. That opposition could be strengthened. That's definitely the September question. You're then looking at the, you know, the buffers are approaching very, very quickly because you've got the party conference season, unless there's an election. And, you know, there just isn't the room to do anything there. The logical thing for Johnson to do, if he's going to do some dramatic thing, is actually to cut Northern Ireland free, because that is the one thing that he would probably get away with in terms of the border down the Irish Sea. If he did that, I think he would probably still be pretty popular on, in the Tory party, but it would be catastrophic for relations with the DUP and with the Republic. But it is the one thing he could do to make no deal work and take responsibility for it. And maybe that's why he's trying to say, you know, it's down to the Northern Ireland parties to take responsibility for the backstop. You know, it suddenly strikes me is a more real option now than it was when Theresa May was challenged about it by the DUP last December.
She obviously took a pretty different take on the union than maybe Boris Johnson would take.
If you were to do something like that, it would also have big ramifications for the Scottish Conservatives, because it's been quite clear from Ruth Davidson and figures, the recently sacked David Mundell, that they worry that any decision to almost separate Northern Ireland or treat it differently, it makes the argument for Scottish independence easier or helps the SNP. So I think that if you want to be the unionist party, which is something Theresa May spoke frequently about, as soon as you change your tack on one part of the UK, it is a bit of a slippery slope to keeping that up. But we've seen Boris Johnson this week with his tour of the union, which we touched on, so visiting Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland. I think the aim was to try and suggest that his Brexit plans aren't going to undermine the union. I don't think that necessarily worked, because it did seem to me that wherever he went, he met figures, even figures in his own party in the form of Ruth Davidson, who are clearly very unhappy with his plans. So I don't think this is resolved at all. He has really reassured that many of these leaders that his plan doesn't risk the union.
We saw him being booed in Scotland, Stephanie, and we saw party after party come out of the meetings in Stormont and sort of criticise his plan or say he wasn't living in the real world as soon as they come out of meetings with him. Do you think that there's something we can tell there more broadly about, you know, Boris Johnson's always been supposed to be the kind of candidate that can reach part of the electorates that others can't? Is his popularity really as you know, across the whole of nations of the UK, really as much as he might try and bid it?
I don't think it is at all. And I think lots of this perception that he can reach out beyond the kind of normal base is because of what he did in London and being elected as mayor. But one, that was a very long time ago now. And also, he wasn't, when he was running for mayor of London, running on a ticket of kind of economic destruction and breaking up, you know, various parts of it, which is in a sense what he's kind of doing right now in terms of saying we're going to have no deal. That could risk Northern Ireland. There's nothing we can do about it. He's a very different politician now. He's not the man that he was when he was first elected in London.
The only thing I'd say on that is that the opinion poll in The Observer last Sunday showed that he's actually much more popular than Jeremy Corbyn on almost every count except
one. But Theresa May was
well, that was...
I mean, it's a low bar.
It is a low bar, but, I mean, that's the bout he's taking part in. There's an openness to Boris Johnson that people on the left would be very, very foolish not to recognise, because it's incredibly early days. So, I mean, the poll taken 3 days after he became Prime Minister in the end will probably mean nothing. But he's a resourceful figure. He's a good communicator in his own irritating way. And, you know, I don't think he should be underestimated.
Yeah, I was struck, and clearly the House of Commons chamber is not an example of society at large, but I was struck when he had his first appearance on the dispatch box. And there are lots of figures in the Tory party who are not happy that he is their new leader, that he is the Prime Minister. But he did seem to really rally everyone. And I saw people cheering by the end of it who had entered looking very miserable about the situation. And I do think that when you get him out campaigning, he can clearly flop. If you look at his time as Foreign Secretary, something he never refers to, it was not a good time for him. But when he was Foreign Secretary, he was almost trying to be a different type of politician. He was trying to be serious. You look at his speeches. He was almost putting on the suit for size to try and as Foreign Secretary, he was trying to be a more serious politician than he was comfortable being. And clearly that's because of the seriousness of the office. Now he is in the greatest office of state there is, but he is almost back to these long speeches, which don't really seem to have much defined purpose or clear rhetoric. Instead, they are more, you know, bumbling around politician, but it's what he is much more comfortable doing. And I think that that is a sign of how he plans to play it and try and make it this Mayor of London return, rather than trying to be a different type of politician.
Now, with divisions in the Tories and in Labour, it seems the perfect time for a Lib Dem revival. With a new leader who is hot on the pursuit of power, one of their first campaigns isn't in Westminster, but in Wales. In June, a recall petition was held in the constituency of Brecon and Radnorshire, and residents voted to remove their Tory MP Chris Davis after a false expenses claim. The seat is a Lib Dem Tory marginal, and if the Lib Dems are successful, it would bring Boris Johnson's working majority in Parliament down to just one. In other words, these tiny rural villages, where there are 10 times more sheep than people, could make it even harder to deliver Brexit by October 31st. We'll find out the result of the election tomorrow. Martin, what does it mean for the Lib Dems to win this? Is it do or die for them?
It would be die if they don't win it. But winning it would confirm that they are back in the game. This is certainly a seat they should win. They won it in the last by-election there, which was in 1985, so more than a generation ago. And also because both Plaid Cymru and the Greens have stood aside. So, you know, they've been given a pretty clear run. Everything is well set up for the Liberal Democrats to win. If they don't do it, it's really bad news for Jo Swinson, and a lot of air goes out of that particular balloon. But it's, you know, the fact that there is a by-election in a seat they can win at the moment, and there conceivably could be a by-election in another seat they could win in Sheffield Hallam, not too far down the line, is really very good news for Jo Swinson. But she needs to keep the momentum going, and she also needs to rely on Jeremy Corbyn not being replaced.
Katie, have the Tories written it off? I mean, they've obviously reselected Chris Davis, who is the MP who was removed after a false expenses claim by a petition, and he's standing again in the constituency. Is that just so CCHQ have got a fool guy for when they lose it?
Yeah, it's a very strange situation. You look at it and it does seem as though the Tories are following a guide on how not to win a by-election in many senses, to pick the same candidate after this is a recall position to have him removed and to spark this by-election, who has been found guilty of expenses fraud. I do think they were trying potentially to find cover, but then I always wonder if you were going between cock up and conspiracy, often it is the former rather than the latter. I think there is some frustration in the new government that this has been allowed to happen, because these were decisions taken before Boris Johnson was in place. And actually, if you look at some of the, you know, the fundamentals in this seat, the fact that there are lots of Leave voters there, the Brexit Party is running, but it seemed to have quite a disastrous campaign themselves in the area. You do get the sense that with a different candidate, there could be a fight to be had. I think if the Lib Dems don't get it, is quite disastrous for them, but had Boris Johnson been in charge when more of the fundamentals were being selected for how to fight this, I think we might be looking at a slightly different picture in terms of attack lines and also just the level of energy there, because I do think most Tories have just written this off.
Stephanie, it's a bit of a test for a sort of Remain alliance idea. I mean, we've seen it in a few seats before, but this is where the Greens and Plaid Cymru standing aside to let the Lib Dems have a sort of free run at it. And what difference do you think something like that would make? And is it a model for the future?
Well, it should make a difference. I think what will be quite interesting is it's also a Leave seat. It's not a typical kind of...
It's about 52.
52. It's not an overwhelming, particularly of the kind of current Lib Dem model of going, you know, very anti-Brexit in terms of how that works. So I think everyone's right. I think if they do win it, and they probably should win it, it will also prove that it's not just the pure Remainer heartlands of people that, you know, go on the demos and do all of that will go and vote for them. So I think it will show them as a real kind of stronghold in terms of how that is. And I think it also proves, if that does do well, just how important it is that Labour manages to kind of actually come up with any form of coherency when it comes to their Brexit strategy and what they want to do. Because I think otherwise, If not, there could be a situation at the next election where they get far more damage done to them.
Do you think it will tell us anything about Brexit if the Lib Dems win this seat? Or is it more, will it be more to do with a dissatisfaction with the Conservative Party and generally how the country's being run and with the candidate than really telling us an awful lot about whether there's been a big switch to Remain in the country?
I think we should be careful about attributing too much Brexit to this. I mean, the Liberal Democrats have been fighting their campaign on domestic bread and butter lamb issues very much. They also, it's worth saying, have a very good candidate. Mm-hmm. And if she does win, that's another very good, articulate Liberal Democrat woman in the House of Commons who will, I think, be quite an important MP if they go further. But it's a huge, sprawling constituency. It's one of the very biggest in the country in area terms. You know, it's got quite middle-class bits, but also very remote, poor, very reliant on subsidy hill farming in much of the rest of it.
Katie, we're kind of writing off the Tories, but is it possible that they could win, particularly as, I guess, we haven't mentioned too much about the Brexit Party campaign. So if they don't do that well and if their vote isn't split, is it possible the Tories could come through?
Yeah, it's possible. It'd be a big surprise. I think what would be interesting is if the Lib Dems win, but by a small margin, I think there will be questions asked as to how the Tories have run this, because I think there's been this assumption that they can't win it. So perhaps they will sneak through. I think what's interesting is we appear to be gearing up to a general election, whether it's autumn, Easter, onwards, but with this dwindling working majority, where it could well come down to which of these four-party race, who hurts the two main parties more? Is it the Liberal Democrats eating into the Labour vote share, or is it the Brexit Party eating into the Conservative vote share? So I think every by-election where you have a Brexit Party influence is interesting, because in Peterborough, it was, I think, the Tories' worst nightmare, which is that the Labour vote didn't increase, but you had the Brexit Party eat into the Tory vote share to the point that they could just go through the middle. And I think that actually, if the Tories were to win this, would be a big surprise. But I think what the Conservatives are going to be looking at is how does the Brexit Party affect them, to what level, and that's how big a threat they are going to be in an election.
Final word, Stephanie, that the possibility of a by-election in Sheffield Hallam, Jared Amar has said that he is going to resign as the MP there when Parliament comes back. That will be a real test, because that will be a Labour-Lib Dem fight, won't it? And what will that mean?
It really will. And I think if there are constituents in Sheffield who don't particularly trust the Labour Party after the last election, I wouldn't particularly blame them. But it was also quite a shock in 2017 that we won that seat. You know, it was very traditionally a Lib Dem seat. If we do lose it, which I think could be probably quite likely, people will try and sweep that under the carpet of the kind of, it was a 2017 anomaly rather than particularly a particular Labour area. That will be the test for kind of Jo Swinson and the Liberal Democrats of how well can they come back and really kind of show their power in that sense and the new electoral force that they can be to the Labour Party.
Well, that's all we have time for this week and for the summer. We'll be back in September. My thanks to all our guests, Katie Balls, Stephanie Lloyd and Martin Kettle. The producer was Chika Ayres. I'm Jessica Elgott. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.